Charles Reed advised, make 'em laugh, make 'em cry, make 'em wait. Lastly, not all expositional facts are of equal value to the telling, and therefore do not deserve equal emphasis. In a separate file, list every fact in your story, and then rank them in order of importance to the reader or audience. As you rewrite and polish your work, you may realize that certain facts need to be stressed and repeated in more than one scene to guarantee that the reader or audience remembers them at a critical future turning point. Other less important facts need only a single hint or gesture. Showing versus telling. The axiom, show, don't tell, warns against dialogue that substitutes passive explanations for dynamic dramatization. To show means to present a scene in an authentic setting, populated with believable characters, struggling toward their desires, taking true-to-the-moment actions while speaking plausible dialogue. To tell means to force characters to halt their pursuits and talk instead and at length about their life histories or their thoughts and feelings or their loves and hates, past and present, for no reason intrinsic to the scene or its characters. Stories are metaphors for life, not theses on psychology, environmental crises, social injustice, or any cause extraneous to the characters' lives. Too often, recitations of this kind simply serve the writer's extrinsic need to opine into the ear of the captive reader or audience, rather than a character's intrinsic need to take action. What's worse, telling erases subtext. As a character copes with antagonisms and pursues desires, her vocal reactions and tactics invite readers and audiences to seek her unspoken thoughts and feelings. But when a writer forces unmotivated exposition into a character's mouth, these opaque lines block the storygoer's access to the speaker's inner life. And as characters flatten into a spokesperson for an author's ideas, interest fades. Finally, showing speeds involvement and pace, telling discourages curiosity and halts pace. Showing treats readers and audiences like adults, inviting them into the story, encouraging them to open their emotions to the writer's vision, to look into the heart of things, and then forward to future events. Telling treats them like a child who a parent sits on a knee to explain the obvious. This speech, for example, is telling, as Harry and Charlie unlock the door to their dry cleaning business, Charlie says,
"Oh, Harry, how long have we known each other now? What, 20 years? Maybe even more, ever since we were in school together? It's been a long time, hasn't it, old friend? Well, how are you this fine morning?"
That dialogue has no purpose except to tell the reader or audience that Charlie and Harry have been friends for 20 years, went to school together, and the day is just beginning. This speech, on the other hand, shows, as Charlie unlocks the door to the dry cleaners, an unshaven Harry, dressed in a T-shirt, leans against the jamb, toking on a joint and giggling uncontrollably. Charlie looks over at him and shakes his head.
"Harry, when in hell are you going to grow up? Look at you and your stupid tie-dye shirts. You're the same immature ass you were 20 years ago in school, and you haven't changed since. Sober up, Harry, and smell the shit you're in."
The reader's imagination, or the audience's eye, glances to Harry to capture his reaction to that insult, and invisibly, as it were, they happen to have learned 20 years and school. At some point, every vital fictional fact must find its way into the story, timed to arrive at the most effective moment, loaded to deliver a critical insight. These details, and the perceptions they inspire, must pass into the reader or audience's awareness without distracting them from the flow of events. Somehow, the writer must send the reader or audience's attention in one direction while he smuggles a fact in from another. This sleight of hand calls upon one of two techniques, or both, narrative drive and exposition as ammunition. The former skill draws on intellectual curiosity, the latter emotional empathy. Narrative drive. Narrative drive is a side effect of the mind's engagement with story. Change and revelations incite the storygoer to wonder what's going to happen next, what's going to happen after that, how will this turn out? As pieces of exposition slip out of dialogue and into the background awareness of the reader or audience member, her curiosity reaches ahead with both hands to grab fistfuls of the future to pull her through the telling. She learns what she needs to know when she needs to know it, but she's never consciously aware of being told anything because what she learns compels her to look ahead. Witness, for example, the power of exposition to compel narrative drive in a novel titled After a Piece of Exposition, Catch 22. The author, Joseph Heller, invented the term to name bureaucratic traps that cage their victims in a vicious circle of logic. The story takes place on an Air Force base in the Mediterranean during World War II. In Chapter 5, Captain John Yossarian, the novel's protagonist, asks Dr. Dan Danica, the base physician, about a pilot named Orr.
Is Orr crazy?
He sure is, Dr. Danica said.
Can you ground him?
I sure can, but first he has to ask me to. That's part of the rule.
Then why doesn't he ask you to?
Because he's crazy, Dr. Danica said. He has to be crazy to keep flying combat missions after all the close calls he's had. Sure, I can ground Orr, but first he has to ask me to.
That's all he has to do to be grounded?
That's all. Let him ask me.
And then you can ground him?
Yossarian asked. No, then I can't ground him.
You mean there's a catch?
Sure there's a catch, Dr. Nika replied. Catch 22. Anyone who wants to get out of combat duty isn't really crazy. There was only one catch, and that was Catch 22, which specified that a concern for one's own safety in the face of dangers that were real and immediate was the process of a rational mind. Orr was crazy and could be grounded. All he had to do was ask, and as soon as he did, he would no longer be crazy and would have to fly more missions. Or would be crazy to fly more missions and sane if he didn't. But if he was sane, he had to fly them. If he flew them, he was crazy and didn't have to. But if he didn't want to, he was sane and had to. Yossarian was moved very deeply by the absolute simplicity of this clause of Catch 22 and let out a respectful whistle.
That's some catch, that Catch 22, he observed.
It's the best there is, Dr. Nika agreed.
Notice how Heller inserted a passage of indirect dialogue into a scene of dramatized dialogue. The prose paragraph summary tells us what Danica said to Yossarian and how Yossarian whistled in reaction to it. Even though it's in a third-person voice that adds a touch of authorial commentary, this is showing and not telling for these reasons. One, it happens within the scene. Two, it furthers the dynamic actions of the scene. Danica wants Yossarian to stop pestering him with excuses to get out of combat, and Yossarian suddenly realizes the futility of claiming to be crazy. Danica's revelation becomes a turning point that moves the Yossarian plot to the negative. In terms of narrative drive, the instant the reader grasps the inescapable logic of Catch-22, her expectations leap ahead. How, if possible, she wonders, will Yossarian or any of the other characters escape the vice grip of this absurd military rule. The reader or the audience's constant search for answers to questions, aroused by revelations of exposition, propels narrative drive. Exposition as ammunition. The second technique for passing exposition unnoticed to the reader or audience relies on the storygoer's emotional involvement. Empathy begins with this thought. That character is a human being like me. Therefore, I want that character to get whatever the character wants, because if I were that character, I'd want the same thing for myself. The moment the storygoer recognizes a shared humanity between herself and your characters, she not only identifies with them, but transfers her real-life desires onto their fictional desires. Once this empathetic connection hooks involvement, the technique of exposition as ammunition operates in this way. Your cast has the knowledge of the past, present, and themselves, and each other that your readers or audience will need to know in order to follow events. Therefore, at pivotal moments, let your characters use what they know as ammunition in their struggles to get what they want. These revelations will deliver the pleasure of discovery to the emotionally invested reader or audience as the fact quickly vanishes into the storygoer's background awareness. Consider, for example, the original Star Wars trilogy. All three films hinge on one story fact. Darth Vader is Luke Skywalker's father. The storytelling problem for George Lucas was when and how to deliver that piece of exposition. He could have revealed it at any point in the first film by having C-3PO whisper to R2-D2, "Don't tell Luke, he'd really be upset to hear this, but Darth's his dad." The fact would have reached the audience, but with minimal, almost laughable effect. Instead, he employed exposition as ammunition to turn the trilogy's most famous scene. At the story climax of the second film, The Empire Strikes Back, Luke Skywalker makes a hero's choice to fight Darth Vader. As lightsabers clash, the archvillain takes command, and the underdog struggles. Empathy for Luke and anxiety about the outcome lock the audience into the moment. In the conventional action climax, the hero finds an unforeseen way to turn tables on the villain. Instead, in the midst of the duel, George Lucas puts in play a motivation he has hidden in the subtext. Darth Vader wants his estranged son to join him on the infamous dark side, but faces a lesser of two evils dilemma: kill his own child or be killed by him. To escape this dilemma, Vader uses one of the most famous pieces of exposition in film history as ammunition to disarm his son. "I am your father." But instead of saving his son with his revelation, he drives Luke to attempt suicide. Suddenly, the truth hidden behind the first two films shocks and moves the audience to compassion for Luke and fear for his future. This biographical fact, used as ammunition, delivers massive retrospective insight into deep character and past events, floods the audience with feeling, and sets up the trilogy's final episode. Revelations. In almost every story ever told, comedy or drama, the most important expositional facts are secrets, dark truths that characters hide from the world, even from themselves. And when do secrets come out in life? When a person faces a lesser of two evils dilemma. If I reveal my secret, I risk losing the respect of those I love, versus, but if I do not reveal my secret, something even worse will happen. The pressure of this dilemma pries secrets loose, and as they come to light, their impact spins powerful turning points. And where do secrets come from? backstory, past events that propel future events. Backstory is an often misunderstood term, misused to mean life history. A character's biography contains a lifelong interaction of genes and experience. Backstory is a subset of this totality. An excerpt from the past, usually secret, events that the writer exposes at key moments to propel his story to climax. Because revelations from the backstory often inflict more impact than straightforward actions, they are reserved for major turning points. Below is a famous example of this technique. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? In this play, written by Edward Elby in 1962, George and Martha, a middle-aged couple, endure a conflict-filled marriage. For two decades, they have fought constantly over every minute aspect of the raising of their son, Jim. After an exhausting, raucous, drink-filled, insult-filled, adulterous party, topped off with a vicious argument about their son in front of their guests, George turns to Martha and says,
"We got a little surprise for you, baby. It's about Sonny Jim."
"No more, George."
"Yes. Sweetheart, I'm afraid I've got some bad news for you. For us, of course, some rather sad news."
"What is this?"
"Well, Martha, while you were out of the room, well, the doorbell chimed, and, well, it's hard to tell you, Martha."
"Tell me."
"And what it was good old Western Union, some little boy, about 70.
"Crazy Billy?"
"Yes, Martha, that's right, Crazy Billy. And he had a telegram, and it was for us, and I have to tell you about it."
"Why didn't they phone it? Why did they bring it? Why didn't they telephone it?"
"Some telegrams you have to deliver, Martha. Some telegrams you can't phone."
"What do you mean?"
"Martha, I can hardly bring myself to say it. Well, Martha, I'm afraid our boy isn't coming home for his birthday."
"Of course he is."
"No, Martha."
"Of course he is. I say he is."
"He can't."
"He is. I say so."
"Martha, our son is dead. He was killed late in the afternoon on a country road, his learner's permit in his pocket. He swerved to avoid a porcupine and drove straight into a large tree."
"You can't do that. You cannot do that."
"I thought you should know."
"No. No, you cannot do that. You can't decide that for yourself. I will not let you do that."
"We'll have to leave around noon, I suppose."
"I will not let you decide these things."
"Because there's matters of identifications, naturally, and arrangements to be made."
"You can't do this. I will not let you do this."
"You do not seem to understand, Martha. I haven't done anything. Now pull yourself together. Our son is dead. Can you get that into your head?"
"You can't decide these things."
"Now listen, Martha. Listen carefully. We got a telegram. There was a car accident, and he's dead. Poof. Just like that. Now, how do you like it?"
"No. No. He is not dead. He is not dead."
"He is dead. Kyrie eleison. Christi eleison. Kyrie eleison."
"You cannot. You may not decide these things."
"That's right, Martha. I'm not God. I don't have power over life and death, do I?"
"You can't kill him. You can't have him die."
"There was a telegram, Martha."
"Show it to me. Show me the telegram."
"I ate it."
"What did you just say to me?"
"I ate it." "Good for you, Martha."
The climax of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf turns on the revelation of George and Martha's backstory secret. Jim, their contentious son, is imaginary. They made him up to fill their empty marriage. The use of backstory to turn story is the single most powerful technique in the execution of exposition. Direct telling. The admonition to show rather than tell only applies to dramatized dialogue in acted scenes. Skillful, straightforward telling, whether on page, stage, or screen, whether in narratized dialogue or third-person narration, has two vital virtues, speed and counterpoint. 1. Speed. Narration can pack a lot of exposition into a few fast words, plant understanding in the reader or audience, and move on. Inner monologues have the power to turn subtext into text in a blink. A character's conversations with herself can leap randomly from memory to memory in free association, or flash with images that bob up from her subconscious. Such passages, beautifully written, can move emotion within a sentence. For example, from the Gabriel Garcia Marquez novel, 100 Years of Solitude.
Many years later, as he faced the firing squad, Colonel Aureliano Buendia was to remember that distant afternoon when his father took him to discover ice.
This is swift, vivid telling. A complex, concentrated image in a single sentence. However, all too often, filmic narration becomes a device to pump out bland exposition in the format of and then, and then, and then. This practice substitutes the easy work of telling for the arduous task of showing. Dialogue scenes on film and television that dramatize complex characters demand talent, knowledge, and imagination. Word-thick narrations only need a keyboard. To turn narratized exposition into a dramatized scene, call upon one of two techniques. 1. Interpolate a scene. Convert the and then and then and then of telling into a narrated scene of dramatized I said, he said, I said, she said. Narrators, whether first person in prose, on stage, or voiceover on screen, can either act out a scene's dialogue verbatim from memory or use indirect dialogue to suggest it. The Netflix series House of Cards, for example, often interpolates scenes of indirect dialogue. Kevin Spacey's Frank Underwood frequently turns to the camera and talks to us as if he were a professor and we were his students in a course on political tradecraft. In this aside, Underwood dramatizes exposition by giving us insights into himself as well as a character named Donald. Underwood acts out Donald's character flaw in this vivid two-sentence metaphorical scene.
What Amara craves more than anything is a sword to fall on. So you sharpen the blade, hold it at the right angle, and then 3, 2, 1.
In the next beat, just as Professor Frank predicted, Donald takes the fall for Underwood's misdeeds. 2. Generate inner conflict. Stage a self-to-self duel, in which one side of a narrating character argues with another. 2 film examples. Frank Pierce, Nicolas Cage, in Martin Scorsese's Bringing Out the Dead, or the adult Ralphie Parker, Gene Shepard, in Bob Clark's A Christmas Story. 2. Counterpoint. In my experience, the narration technique that most enriches a story is counterpoint. Rather than using a narrator to tell the tale, some writers fully dramatize their story, then appoint a narrator to contradict or ironize its themes. They may use wit to ridicule the dramatic, or the dramatic to deepen the satire. They may counterpoint the personal with the social, or the social with the personal. Take, for example, John Fowles's postmodern historical anti-novel novel, The French Lieutenant's Woman. Half the pages dramatize the story of Charles Smithson, a Victorian gentleman, and his involvement with Sarah Woodruff, a disgraced governess. Interlaced with this tale, however, A narrator with modern knowledge of 19th century culture and class conflicts undercuts the Charles and Sarah romance. Counterpoint after counterpoint, the narrator argues that the 19th century offered women without means far more misery than romance. Other examples. In Itumamaten Bien, the voiceover narrator frequently reminds the audience of Mexico's social suffering as a counterpoint to the coming-of-age drama. Woody Allen's witty voiceover in Annie Hall counterpoints his protagonist's self-inquisition. In Samuel Beckett's play, Play, a trio of characters, buried to the neck in urns, stare out over the audience and narrate their seemingly random thoughts in a three-way system of counterpoint. Prose is the natural medium for direct telling. The novelist and the short story writer can foreground exposition as nakedly as they wish and draw it out for as many pages as they wish, so long as their language captivates and satisfies. Charles Dickens, for example, opens A Tale of Two Cities with a burst of counterpointing exposition that hooks the reader's curiosity.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. We had everything before us. We had nothing before us. We were all going direct to heaven. We were all going direct the other way.
Notice how Dickens's omniscient third-person narration uses we to put an arm around the reader's shoulder and draw him into the telling. Compare that to the confrontational first-person, fast-paced voice of I that opens Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man.
I am an invisible man. No, I am not a spook like those who haunted Edgar Allan Poe. Nor am I one of your Hollywood movie ectoplasms. I am a man of substance, of flesh and bone, fiber and liquids. And I might even be said to possess a mind. I am invisible, understand, simply because people refuse to see me. Like the bodiless heads you see sometimes in circus sideshows. It is as though I have been surrounded by mirrors of hard, distorting glass. When they approach me, they see only my surroundings, themselves, or figments of their imagination. Indeed, everything and anything except me.
In later chapters, both Dickens and Ellison dramatize scenes, but some prose writers never do. Instead, they pave page after page with direct telling narration, never acting out a single event. Try to imagine how you might dramatize the exposition in the two passages you just heard into scenes of actable dialogue. In theory, it could be done. Shakespeare could have managed it, but with what difficulty? When writing for readers, telling works wonders. When writing for actors, the reverse is true. Ideally, in the performance arts of stage and screen, exposition flows to the audience unnoticed within the spoken words. As we've seen, the craft of rendering exposition invisible takes patience, talent, and technique. Lacking these three qualities, impatient and uninspired screenwriters force exposition on the audience and hope to be forgiven. Forced exposition. Since the dawn of cinema, filmmakers have inserted shots of newspapers with foot-high headlines announcing events such as war. They have walked characters past televisions or radios, conveniently tuned to a news broadcast of exactly what the audience needs to know, precisely when it needs to know it. Rapidly edited montages and split-screen collages have packed screens with as much information as possible in the briefest possible time. Filmmakers rationalize these devices with the notion that if exposition comes fast and flashy, it won't bore the audience. They would be wrong. Similar thinking governs opening films with a title role, as did Star Wars, which delivered rapid-fire exposition and a tone of grandiosity, or closing with one, as did A Fish Called Wanda, which got laughs and a touch more closure. When thrillers race against time, hopscotching from place to place, they often superimpose location names and dates over establishing shots. In such cases, a little telling goes a long way. With a brief halt for a cogent image or a quick printed fact, the story stubs its toe but then strides on, and the audience shrugs it off. But audiences will not forgive a deluge of facts artlessly shoehorned into dialogue for no intrinsic reason to the characters or the scene. When inept writing forces characters to tell each other facts they already know, the pace trips over a high hurdle, falls face first into the cinders, and may never get up. For example, interior, luxurious great room, day. John and Jane sit on a silk-tasseled sofa, sipping martinis.
Oh, my goodness, darling. How long have we known and loved each other now? Why, it's over 20 years, isn't it?
Yes, ever since we were at the university together, and your fraternity threw a mixer and invited the Women's Socialist Club. Your house was so rich, we poor girls called Beta, Tau, Zeta, billions, trillions, and zillions.
Yes. And then I lost my inheritance. But we both worked very hard over the years to make our dreams come true. And they did. Didn't they, my little Trotskyite?
This exchange tells the reader seven fictional facts. This couple is rich. They are in their 40s. They met within the elite of their university. He was born to a wealthy family. She grew up in poverty. They once had opposite political views, but no longer. And over the years, they've developed a banter that's so sweet it hurts your teeth. The scene is false, and its dialogue tinny, because the writing is dishonest. Characters are not doing what they seem to be doing. They seem to be reminiscing, but in fact, they're mouthing exposition so the eavesdropping audience can overhear it. As mentioned above, prose writers can avoid these fake scenes by sketching a brief marital history that strings facts together with a pleasing style. If they wish, prose writers can, within limits, simply tell their readers what they need to know. Some playwrights and screenwriters ape novelists by resorting to narration. But with rare exceptions, direct address on stage and voiceover on screen cannot mete out exposition with the intellectual power and emotional impact of fully dramatized dialogue. To make this point to yourself, do an exercise in exposition as ammunition. Rewrite the scene you just heard so that the two characters use their expositional facts as weapons during a fight in which one character forces the other to do something that he or she does not want to do. Now do it again, but this time put the same facts into a seduction scene in which one character uses what he or she knows as ammunition to subtly manipulate the other into doing something the other does not wish to do. Write the scene so that the exposition becomes invisible and the character's behaviors credible. In other words, write it so that the conflict or seduction fascinates the reader or audience, and the exposition they need to know slips unawares, invisibly, as it were, into their minds. Characterization. The second function of dialogue is the creation and expression of a distinctive characterization for each character in the cast. Human nature can be usefully divided into two grand aspects: appearance, who the person seems to be, versus reality, who the person actually is. Writers, therefore, design characters around two corresponding parts known as true character and characterization. True character, as the term implies, names a character's profound psychological and moral being, a truth that can only be revealed when life backs the character into a pressure-filled corner and forces him to make choices and take actions. The principle of choice is foundational to all storytelling, fictional and non-fictional. To wit, a character's true self can only be expressed through risk-filled choices of action in the pursuit of desire. Characterization denotes a character's total appearance, the sum of all surface traits and behaviors. It performs three functions: to intrigue, to individualize, to convince. One, to intrigue. The reader or audience knows that a character's appearance is not her reality, that her characterization is a persona, a mask of personality suspended between the world and the true character behind it. When the reader or audience encounters a one-of-a-kind personality, they listen to the character's words and naturally wonder, "That's who she seems to be, but who is she really? Is she actually honest or a liar? Loving or cruel? Wise or foolish? Cool or rash? Strong or weak? Good or evil? What is the core identity behind her intriguing characterization? What is her true character?" Having hooked the reader or audience's curiosity, the story becomes a series of surprising revelations that answer these questions. Two, to convince. A well-imagined, well-designed characterization assembles capacities, mental, physical, and behaviors, emotional, verbal, that encourage the reader or audience to believe in a fictional character as if she were factual. As the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge noted two centuries ago, the reader or audience knows that stories and characters are not actual. But they also know that to involve themselves in the telling, they must temporarily believe, or more precisely, they must willingly suspend their disbelief and accept the character's actions and reactions without doubt, without argument. If your reader or audience thinks the thought, "I don't believe a word she says," because they sense your character is a liar, that could be a revelation of true character. But if they think the same thought because they don't simply believe in your character, then it's time for a rewrite. Three, to individualize. A well-imagined, well-researched characterization creates a unique combination of biology, upbringing, physicality, mentality, emotionality, education, experience, attitudes, values, tastes, and every possible nuance of cultural influence that has given the character her individuality. Moving through her days, pursuing career, relationships, sexuality, health, happiness, and the like, she gathers behaviors into a one-of-a-kind personality. And the most important trait of all, talk. She speaks like no one we have ever met before. Her language style not only sets her apart from all other cast members, but also, if the writing is masterful, from all other fictional characters. A recent example, Jeanette Jasmine Francis, Kate Blanchett, in Woody Allen's Blue Jasmine. Dialogue to characterize will be fully explored in chapters 10 and 11. Action. Dialogue's third essential function is to equip characters with the means for action. Stories contain three kinds of action: mental, physical, and verbal. Mental action. Words and images compose thoughts. But a thought does not become a mental action until it causes change within a character. Change in attitude, belief, expectation, understanding, and the like. A mental action may or may not translate into outer behavior, but even if it stays secret and unexpressed, the character who took the mental action is not quite the same person afterward as she was before. Character change through mental action impels much of modern storytelling. Physical action. Physical action comes in two fundamental kinds, gestures and tasks. By gestures, I mean all varieties of body language, facial expression, hand movements, posture, touch, proxemics, vocalics, kinesics, and the like. These behaviors either modify spoken language or substitute for it, expressing feelings words cannot. By tasks, I mean activities that get something done, working, playing, traveling, sleeping, lovemaking, fighting, daydreaming, reading, admiring a sunset, and the like. All those actions that do not require talk. Verbal action. As novelist Elizabeth Bowen put it, dialogue is what characters do to each other. On the level of outer behavior, a character's dialogue style melds with his other traits to create his surface characterization. But at the inner level of true character, the actions he takes into the world reveal his humanity or lack of it. What's more, the greater the pressure in the scene, the more he stands to lose or gain in that moment, the more his actions tell us who he really is. What a character says, however, only moves the reader or audience if the actions he takes beneath his lines ring true to that specific character in that specific moment. Therefore, before writing a line, ask these questions. What does my character want out of this situation? At this precise moment, what action would he take in an effort to reach that desire? What exact words would he use to carry out that action? Spoken words suggest what a character thinks and feels. The action he takes beneath his words expresses his identity. To uncover a character's inner life, seek the subtextual action and label it with an active gerund, an ing phrase. Below are the four dialogue quotes from the preface. Listen into the subtext of each and name the character's action with a gerund. When done, compare your interpretations to mine.
Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time, and all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death.
Macbeth, in the tragedy of Macbeth. Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, she walks into mine. Rick, in Casablanca.
Towards thee I roll, thou all-destroying but unconquering whale. To the last I grapple with thee, from hell's heart I stab at thee. For hate's sake I spit my last breath at thee.
Ahab, in Moby Dick.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. Jerry in Seinfeld.
All four quotes imply disgust, but Macbeth, Rick Blaine, Ahab, and Jerry Seinfeld express their disdain in such radically different speech styles that their personalities could not be more unlike. Dialogue style, as the door to characterization, will be the focus of Part 3. My sense of the deep character under the four speeches suggests these subtextual actions. Macbeth, denouncing existence. Rick Blaine, lamenting lost love. Ahab, blaspheming God's power. Jerry Seinfeld, ridiculing the political correctness that protects asinine behavior from ridicule. Your interpretations of implied action may differ from mine. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But the purpose of this exercise is to reveal the difference between the activity of talk and the taking of action. Part 4 will further demonstrate this technique by parsing 7 scenes beat by beat to separate their outer language from their inner actions and trace how these dynamic designs motivate what's said as they arc scenes around their turning points. Chapter 3, Expressivity 1. Content. As You Like It, Act 2, Scene 7.
All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts.
Jacques believes that in the theater of life, everyone acts out his own cast of characters decade after decade, from infant to adult to geezer. Jacques steps back to survey this pattern from a philosophical, objective, long-term, outside-in public point of view. But in order to create Jacques' dark doctrine, Shakespeare worked from the reverse perspective, psychological, subjective, here and now, inside out, and profoundly private. As you compose dialogue, I think it's useful to imagine character design as 3 concentric spheres, one inside the other, a self within a self within a self. This 3-tiered complex fills dialogue with content of thought and feeling while shaping expression in gesture and word. The innermost sphere churns with the unsayable. The middle sphere restrains the unsaid. The outer sphere releases the said. The said. The surface level of things said supports the more or less solid meanings that words, spoken or written, directly express with both denotations and connotations. Snake, for example, literally means a legless reptile. But in Western culture, it also symbolizes treachery and evil. The word house connotes more than a domicile. It carries overtones of home, hearth, and family, plus undertones of shack, crash pad, and flophouse. This is why quotable dialogue such as "Get busy livin' or get busy dyin'," said by Ellis Boyd Red Redding in The Shawshank Redemption, and "I'm just one stomach flu away from my goal weight," said by Emily Charlton in The Devil Wears Prada, outlive their stories and their characters. These sentences express their meaning no matter who says it or when. Word choices such as "busy dying," "stomach flu," naturally enrich the lines with connotations from the culture outside their fictional setting. But because a specific character in a specific situation speaks the lines with a specific purpose, a whole new and deeper realm comes into play, the character's intelligence, imagination, and other genetic givens. By creating an original dialogue style of vocabulary, diction, syntax, grammar, tone, tropes, and accent, the writer characterizes a role. Verbal choices express the character's education, or lack of it, wit, or lack of it, his outlook on life, the range of his emotional behavior, all the observable traits that jigsaw into a personality. The unsaid. A second sphere, the unsaid, revolves within a character. From this inner space, the self gazes out at the world. As thoughts and feelings form at this level, the self deliberately withholds them. Nonetheless, once the character speaks, the text, in other words, readers and audiences instinctively look past the words to intuit the unsaid, to glimpse what the character actually thinks and feels in the subtext, but chooses not to put into words. The writer, therefore, must hone dialogue so this is possible, so that the unsaid can be sensed by implication. When Emily Charlton, played by Emily Blunt, says to Andy Sachs, played by Anne Hathaway, "I'm just one stomach flu away from my goal weight," what she does not say, but we know she's thinking, might go something like this. "The fashion world forces me to live an anorexic life, but I want my career more than my health. Perpetual hunger is the price I'm happy to pay. If you value your job future, you will do the same." Novels thrive at the level of the unsaid. In Chapter 1 of Ian McEwan's Enduring Love, a violent accident kills a man. In the next chapter, as Joe Rose stands among the other survivors, surveying the aftermath, he confides to the reader.
"Clarissa came up behind me and looped her arms around my waist and pressed her face into my back. What surprised me was she was already crying. I could feel the wetness on my shirt, whereas to me, sorrow seemed a long way off. Like a self in a dream, I was both first and third persons. I acted and saw myself act. I had my thoughts, and I saw them drift across a screen. As in a dream, my emotional responses were non-existent or inappropriate. Clarissa's tears were no more than a fact, but I was pleased by the way my feet were anchored to the ground and set well apart, and the way my arms were folded across my chest. I looked out across the fields, and the thought scrolled across, 'That man is dead.' I felt a warmth spreading through me, a kind of self-love, and my folded arms hugged me tight. The corollary seemed to be, 'And I am alive.' It was a random matter who was alive or dead at any given time. I happened to be alive."
The unsayable. Deep as yet, concealed beneath the unsaid, the sphere of the unsayable roils with subconscious drives and needs that incite a character's choices and actions. A character's truest nature can only be expressed when, under the pressures of life, he chooses to act in pursuit of a life-defining desire. As antagonistic pressures build greater and greater power, the character's choices of actions reveal his hidden self, until a final choice, under the maximum pressure of life, exposes the character's primal, irreducible self. How deliberate versus instinctive the motivations are that propel human choice of action has been debated for centuries. But whatever the case, choices begin in this innermost sphere. Language, therefore, cannot express who a character actually is, only who he seems to be. As the Bible teaches, a person is known not by his words, but by his deeds. The truth comes full circle, however, once the writer realizes that words are deeds. Talk is the foremost vehicle for human action. When a character says something, he is, in fact, doing something. By speaking, he could be comforting a loved one, bribing an enemy, begging for help, refusing to help, obeying authority, defying authority, paying the price, remembering the day, and so on down the limitless list of human actions. Dialogue expresses far more than the meaning of its words. As language, dialogue conveys characterization, but as action, dialogue expresses true character. Moment by moment, Your character struggles in pursuit of her desires. She takes actions and uses her spoken words to carry them out. At the same time, however, her language choices convey her inner life, conscious and subconscious, without announcing it. Whether read or acted, fine dialogue creates a transparency that allows the reader or audience to gaze through the text of talk. This phenomenon turns the storygoer into a mind reader. When you read a page of expressive dialogue or watch a fine actor perform a complex scene, your sixth sense invades the character. You become a telepathist, often aware of what's going on inside of her better than she knows herself. Your story-trained sonar traces vibrations down through the character's subconscious currents until the actions she takes in the subtext of her lines enunciate her identity and you discover her profound personal dimensions. If, as some people believe, anything and everything can be expressed in words, we should stop telling stories and write essays instead. But we don't, because at the rock bottom of being, the unsayable energies in the subconscious mind are real and demand expression. Dialogue unites these realms because the spoken word resonates through all three spheres. Dialogue wields the double power to express the effable, characterization, while it illuminates the ineffable, true character. What can be put into words versus what can only be put into action. Dialogue, therefore, is the writer's foremost vehicle for character content. Action versus activity. The axiom, "Nothing is what it seems," expresses the primal duality of life. What seems is the surface of life, the activity we see and hear, the outer behavior of what a character says and how she behaves. What is the substance of life, the action the character takes below the surface of activity. Outer goings-on, such as playing cards, working out, sipping wine, and most of all, talking, are simply activities. These textual behaviors mask the truth of what a character is actually doing. For even though an activity like chatting with a stranger at a bus stop may seem without purpose, it never is. Therefore, no line of dialogue is finished until you've answered this question. In the subtext of my character's verbal activity, what action is he in fact taking? Consider ice cream. We never eat ice cream simply because we're hungry. Like all behaviors, a conscious or subconscious action underlies this activity. What is the ice cream eater really doing? Perhaps he's drowning his sorrows in something sweet, or rebelling against his doctor's orders, or rewarding himself for sticking to his diet. Those actions, drowning sorrows, rebelling, or rewarding, find expression in the activity of eating ice cream. The same of talk. As character A and character B converse, what are they doing? Are the words character A uses consoling character B or ridiculing her? When B reacts, does her dialogue suggest that she is submitting to A or dominating him? Is A feigning interest or falling in love? Is B deceiving A or confessing to him? And on the questioning goes. Behind the textual activities of the characters, what subtextual actions actually drive the scene? An activity, therefore, is simply the surface manifestation of an action. It's the way a character carries out an action. Action is foundational to storytelling, and every activity contains one. Drama is the ancient Greek word for action derived from a verb that means to do or to act. The audiences of classical Greece knew that no matter what was happening on the surface of a play, an inner action drives all outer activity. Extending this principle to the writing of a scene, we realize that even silence has underlying action. Not speaking when a situation calls for talk is an action, perhaps a cruel one aimed at another person. When a character speaks, he is doing something, helping or hurting, begging or bribing, persuading or dissuading, explaining or misleading, attacking or defending, complimenting or insulting, complaining or thanking, and on it goes down an endless list of actions. Even pauses play into a beat of action versus reaction. When a character pauses, she's either reacting to a scene's previous action or preparing her next move. The term dialogue is often contrasted with monologue, as if